You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although it's been over 4 years since the 2008 financial crisis, the liabilities that big banks may be hiding are still unclear. To gain a better understanding of how transparent banks really are, Jesse Eisinger, a senior reporter at ProPublica and a columnist for the New York Times Deal Book section, and Frank Partnoy, a professor of law and finance at the University of San Diego School of Law, investigated Wells Fargo's 236-page annual report, and they found that accounting practices are as opaque as they've ever been. Their article, What's Inside America's Banks, is in the current issue of The Atlantic, and it brings Jesse Eisinger back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Have any steps been taken in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis to make banks more transparent?
Yes, many steps have been taken, but we think that they're largely inadequate. Of course, there was the Dodd-Frank financial reform that many people have heard of, and that is a huge slew of rules covering consumer-friendly products all the way up to complex derivatives. And some of that is good, but taken as a whole, it's probably really counterproductive.
Well, we'll get into the counterproductive in a moment,
sure.
But have the banks been able to find ways around these new laws?
So far, they've done a variety of strategies. One thing is to throw up enormous delays. So many of these rules, 2.5 years after Dodd-Frank was passed, haven't been fully implemented. By the time they will be implemented, we're going to have something on the order of 30,000 different rulemakings. And it's kind of infernally complex.
So it must be difficult for government to keep up with its own rules.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the regulators have a problem, which is that they're in fact very smart. We think of them, the Republicans will tell us that they're dumb bureaucrats or something. In fact, they're not. But in some ways, they're too smart for their own good. So they try to write extremely complex rules that get at every eventuality, trying to envision all the things that could happen to a bank instead of trying to write simpler rules that are principle-based.
Well, the real goal would be to increase transparency. Have we seen an increase in transparency?
Not at all. And that's the crux of Frank and my piece, is that we have extraordinary opacity. It's simply not possible to understand a large American bank, or really a large multinational bank. And even it's not just laymen. It's not just your grandfather ranting about the banks. It's the experts. So sophisticated investors, accounting experts, bankers themselves, the regulators, they don't understand these institutions.
Well, you looked at an annual report. Now, you looked at Wells Fargo's annual report. You chose them instead of Bank of America, for example, or Citibank, or any of a number of other worthy competitors. Because Wells Fargo has a better reputation than some?
Right. Choosing Citi or J.P. Morgan would be shooting fish in a barrel. What we wanted to do was take Wells Fargo, which is an American icon with the Stagecoach, a classic American company that also is viewed as the most conservative bank and the biggest bank with the simplest business model.
And you looked at the annual report. Now, what is the goal of the annual report? To me, when I've received a few, I've always thought, well, these are really glossy, lots of pictures of a lot of happy people working for the company, not intended to reveal any problems.
Well, pretty much that's right. What an annual report does in the first few pages, which is what most of us get through, is set out a beautiful bunch of things that the company does. And, it shows Wells Fargo lending to wonderful people who have smiling faces and are true American souls. And then they hope that you don't read past, page 20. And then they get into the financial disclosures. And the financial disclosures are the SEC-regulated disclosures. And that's all supposed to be disclosing all the relevant risks to the business.
And who's expected to be reading that? Potential investors, government regulators?
Everybody.
Obviously not me. I'm not enough of a numbers cruncher to be able to understand what's there.
Well, ideally, any sophisticated layperson should be able to read the annual report and understand it. If you read the annual report of Procter & Gamble or McDonald's, you would actually understand it, and you could invest in those companies with some confidence. But you cannot do that with a bank. But not only can you not do that, the regulators can't do that. The investors can't do that.
And you compare reading this report to Dante's descent into hell.
Yes. That was Frank's contribution, one of Frank's many contributions, and it was great.
Well, he used to work for the banks, didn't he, before he went into academia?
Exactly. Frank is a lawyer, law professor at the University of San Diego, but before that he was a derivatives trader at Morgan Stanley and one of the early whistleblowers on Wall Street's nefarious practices.
So he should understand what the numbers mean.
He can understand that he doesn't understand.
You found $6.6 billion, this is at Wells Fargo Bank alone, in income labeled other. That's a lot of miscellany. Where was that income coming from?
Right. Largely, that's coming from trading. And one of the surprises we had was that Wells Fargo, this classic American bank that you think is lending a lot of money, turns out to have enormous trading operations. And trading is something that's much different from lending in terms of its risks.
But haven't banks always, on the one hand, lend out money earned from the interest on it, but also taken the money that we put in savings and invested it to increase income?
Not exactly. They always take that money and invest it, but in the olden days, they couldn't trade as well because that would be an investment banking activity. So it used to be under Glass-Steagall, exactly, that there was separation between investment banking and commercial banking. That eroded over time throughout the 80s, and then in the late 90s, we passed the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act that got rid of Glass-Steagall for good.
And there are people who would suggest that we bring back something akin to Glass-Steagall, if not exactly Glass-Steagall.
Exactly, including many bankers themselves. Well, mostly former bankers who have now retired and feel like it's safe to say this from afar. But that's what's sort of surprising, is that you not only have sort of dissidents and critics saying, we can't understand the banks are too big, but you have actual former bankers themselves who say these banks are unmanageable and dangerous.
Because in the old days, they understood what the rules were and they could live by them. And now they're not sure what the rules are?
I think that it's a combination of...
You suddenly find out a guy in Hong Kong has lost you $28 billion and you didn't even know that he was working for you?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the banks have certainly become too big to manage. So you saw that with the J.P. Morgan trading loss earlier this year, the London Whale loss. And then, you know, let's not be naive here. Opacity serves these big banks. They don't really want people to understand their operations. Trading is a business that is your best, is a zero-sum business. When I win, you lose. And so, unlike lending, which is win-win, if you do well, I do well. And so if to the extent that they do more trading, they want their customers to be in the dark.
My guest is Jesse Eisinger, a senior reporter at ProPublica and a columnist for the New York Times Deal Book section. He has written with Frank Portnoy, a professor of law and finance at the University of San Diego School of Law, an article for the current issue of The Atlantic magazine called What's Inside America's Banks. And you found in the case of Wells Fargo that it had lost $377 million from trading derivatives. Now, was this clear or is this something that you had to do a lot of work to uncover?
It's sitting there. It's a line. It's a footnote in tiny print. It had hardly gotten any attention.
The media should have caught that, shouldn't it?
The media should have caught it, but at this point, investors and financial journalists are numb to these kind of large losses. So nobody really sort of understands exactly what the loss consisted of or bothered to find out. In the scheme of things, it's not huge, but objectively, a $377 million loss is big.
Oh, well, it sounds like a lot of money to me. And you couldn't tell from reading this why that money was lost?
You can't tell much of anything when Wells Fargo or any large bank discloses things like its losses from certain trading operations, the kinds of positions it's taking, the risks that it is incurring, and the risk it might face in the future.
So this, we don't get in this annual report how much money the bank is putting at risk in its trades?
No. So you have nothing, you have no sense of the underlying size of the bets. It's like you went to Vegas and you come home and you say, hey, you know, I did pretty well. I only lost $10. Well, it may turn – that could mean that you wagered $20, or it could mean that you wagered $2 million. And you can't know that from reading the annual report. So you have no idea what your real risk was there.
And you compare accounting practices used today to the ones – that were used by Enron. Now, I thought after Enron there was a fallout and we said we're not going to allow that to happen again.
Yeah, there was, and we did, and then the rules got worse. A major bank regulator said to us, he compared the big banks' accounting to Enron. And the problem is that they have this other entire class of businesses that they store off their balance sheet. They're exposed to, but they say, well, the exposure isn't so great and we're not really exposed to it. And they have become, they used to be called special purpose vehicles, SPVs. Now they have some new wonderful acronym, VIEs, variable interest entities. And it's essentially the same thing. And Wells Fargo has almost $1.5 trillion worth of these things.
Wow. Did you contact Wells Fargo during this investigation?
Absolutely. I mean, basic fairness as a journalist would require you to do it. And Frank and I did it early on. And we said we'd like to talk to Wells, somebody at Wells to understand this. And they said, send us your questions in writing. And so we sent us questions in writing. And they said, well, we're not going to talk to you, but we can help you out. So we said, well, so we have questions about such and such exposure. And they said, well, you can find that answer in the annual report on page 87. Well, it turned out that we had our question was derived from page 87. So it was a real circular little journey, a Dante-esque journey into the chasm of bank PR.
Do you think that when people read this article, it will affect their attitude about Wells Fargo? Or is this just, well, this could have happened with any bank, so I shouldn't be surprised?
We hope that it goes beyond Wells Fargo. Because we chose Wells Fargo as an example to shake people because we thought they might be complacent if we took Bank of America or Citigroup, which have such poor reputations. But what our point is larger, which is that there needs to be a radical overhaul of the disclosure regime in this country. That a Federal Reserve governor said to us that you cannot understand the assets, the liabilities, the revenue, the profits, the capital at the banks. In short, you can't understand anything. And it's the Securities and Exchange Commission's job to make sure that companies are disclosing this stuff clearly and adequately. So they could do a much better job here.
Well, we're going to look at some other banks after we take a little break. I'm talking with Jesse Eisinger, who's a senior reporter at ProPublica and a columnist for the New York Times Dealbook section. He has collaborated with Frank Partnoy, a professor of law and finance at the University of San Diego School of Law, to write an article called What's Inside America's Banks. It's in the current issue of The Atlantic. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're talking about an article called What's Inside America's Banks in the current issue of The Atlantic magazine, written by Frank Partnoy, professor of law and finance at the University of San Diego School of Law, and my guest, Jesse Eisinger, a senior reporter at ProPublica and a columnist for the New York Times Dealbook section. Are you moonlighting here, writing for The Atlantic?
Well, it was a collaboration with Frank, and my full-time gig is at ProPublica.
J.P. Morgan was widely scrutinized when it posted multi-billion-dollar trading losses in the spring of 2012. The original report said $2 billion, but that number was later revised to $6 billion. That's a huge difference. What happened inside the bank?
It's a huge problem at J.P. Morgan. The big picture here is that J.P. Morgan was widely regarded as the best managed of the big banks, and Jamie Dimon, the CEO, was supposedly the best CEO. So this really scared people.
And when he goes to Washington, they still bow and scrape.
They
despite
do.
Despite all of this.
They do. And one of the most remarkable things to me about the financial crisis is that not only did no banker, major banker, go to prison or pay any sort of fine, but there doesn't seem to have been any social cost to their failure to running aground.
Or financial cost. The banks, the stocks are booming on the stock market.
Well, the stocks are up. They're up last year, but they're still very depressed. Their valuations are depressed. So J.P. Morgan is trading below book value. That means that the assets, the stated assets on its balance sheet, the market value is actually less than that. And that means that investors either don't believe the asset values or don't believe that these guys will be profitable in the future. That's true for Goldman, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America. Wells is slightly above book value.
So what happened at J.P. Morgan? How did this huge loss occur and then the disparity between $2 billion and $4 billion?
So what happened was there was a small corner of the bank, a little pocket of the bank that was supposed to be a kind of very quiet, steady area for the bank to sort of manage its risks and use its extra cash but not to do anything crazy with it. And there was a trader in London who decided essentially to do a kind of old-fashioned corner of an exotic index, a derivatives index. And he became so big that he, it's the classic story of you call your broker 10 times to say buy, and then the 11th day you say sell, and he says, okay, great, to whom? And the problem is once you do that, you take a huge loss. And hedge funds ganged up on him, and it looks like it to me and many others that he was doing proprietary bets. He was betting the firm's capital for their own profits.
And the head of that division was fired, and she said she had just been made a scapegoat. The suggestion always is that this was just a couple of bad apples.
Right. And that's always the case, essentially rogue trading. But it wasn't a rogue trading operation by any means.
Was it illegal?
It probably wasn't illegal. And there's even a debate. Now, what I said was that this guy was betting, making proprietary bets. Now, supposedly that will be made illegal when the Volcker Rule, the part of Dodd-Frank that is supposed to prevent banks that have deposit insurance from the federal government that prevents them from doing these kinds of bets. Supposedly, this kind of activity will be banned when that's finalized. Now, the question is whether it would have been exempted because there's so many huge exemptions in the Volcker Rule.
Well, why is it taking so long for the Volcker Rule to even be implemented since it was part of the Dodd-Frank legislation?
Well, it's a scandal. And I think that there are two main reasons. One is that the banks have lobbied against it extremely successfully.
Despite all of these embarrassments?
Despite the embarrassments, they still have managed to. They certainly have had the ear of the Obama Treasury Department in the first term. And so Treasury has leaned against any significant strengthening of the Dodd-Frank reforms, especially the Volcker Rule. And then there's been heated lobbying against it. And then also the regulators are trying to make this rule too complex.
The Volcker Rule, you say, is way overcomplicated as it is. What's the story behind it? The Volcker Rule, if it can be stated in one sentence, can't it?
Yes. The Volcker Rule is actually intuitively pretty understandable and almost unobjectionable. In fact, Jamie Dimon himself says he supports it. The Volcker Rule says deposits are insured by the federal government. And so that means the taxpayer has to step in if there's a loss. So you can't take that money that people deposit at the bank and speculate with it. That's banned. You can't speculate it with your own interest. You have to do some classic banking activity, like go and lend that money, which is also risky, but not as risky as making short-term speculative bets.
People are starting to parse out what happened in this fiscal cliff deal. Did the a number of special interests got all sorts of breaks, of, interestingly, motocross race tracks.
Yes.
Did the banks get anything?
You know, that's a very good question, and I've been so knee-deep in the Atlantic piece that I haven't yet read that, so I should come back. I'll come back to you.
A caller says he or she, I don't know whether there's a male or female caller, believes that you can't put the genie back in the bottle now. Since Glass-Steagall was dropped, too much has changed in the structure of the industry, and Dodd-Frank will not be strong enough to make a real difference.
Well, this is what our conclusion is, trying to put the genie back in the bottle. What we want to try to say is that there's got to be a way to overhaul the disclosure regime at these banks to make them much more simple and clear, so that a smart person, but not necessarily an expert, could understand the business. And you could do that because you could have a kind of plain English requirement that said, tell us what your real risks are in language that anybody could understand.
Well, you said that nobody has been punished. Would one of the things that perhaps could change the culture be to make CEOs and CFOs accountable for the risks that they make?
We think so, absolutely. We think that this is an essential part of any true reform, which is, one thing is that they have to disclose their risks clearly and not be misleading. And then if they're found to be misleading, if they're found to be reckless, recklessly misleading, then they have to go to prison. And if you don't face a real risk of going to prison for acting recklessly or criminally in this country, then we cannot have safe banking.
Well, we've seen a number of people, and you mentioned this earlier, who used to be in the business, who have been critical of the current situation. The former president of Merrill Lynch wrote an e-book criticizing current banking practices and revealed all sorts of embarrassing things. We had Greg Smith on this show a little while back,
sure,
to talk about his book, Why I Left Goldman Sachs. But what I remember was when we announced that he was coming on the show, we were flooded with anti-Greg Smith material from people who obviously had some axes to grind, people from the banking industry.
Yeah. You still get extraordinarily punished and blackballed from the industry if you blow the whistle. And that probably explains why the only people who have a change of heart are safely retired with their bank accounts intact. One of the great shames here in the last 4 years is that no statesman has emerged from the banking industry to say, we need to change things.
My guest is Jesse Eisinger of ProPublica and the New York Times, who, with Frank Partnoy, P-A-R-T-N-O-Y, professor of law and finance at the University of San Diego School of Law, collaborated on an article called What's Inside America's Banks. It's in the current issue of The Atlantic. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, many people will tell you the real problem lies with Congress, as everything else in America seems to. And that's because, despite all of these revelations, Congress is not doing anything. Perhaps they say it's because of the influence of lobbyists on Congress.
Yeah, no, I think that that's absolutely clear, and that there's a whole remora class, as I like to think of them, of lobbyists, accounting professionals, lawyers, and they sustain the complexity of the banks. The banks like it too, but this whole class likes it because then they have a sort of proprietary expertise that they can charge a lot of money for. So, and they go to lobby Congress and they lobby the regulators for added complexities that only they can then understand and parse and help the banks navigate. So it is an extremely rotten system that the banks contribute to and that Congress contributes to. But the core of it is deeply corrupt.
A former chairman of the SEC told you that none of the post-2008 remedies have significantly diminished the likelihood of future financial crises. And that's because all of the legislation has allowed for too many loopholes?
It's that there are loopholes. It's that there's a creation of the illusion of safety when we, because of half measures that we've taken to half reform the derivatives markets, to half bring transparency to certain kind of products. And so – and simultaneously, we have bigger banks now. We've allowed for greater consolidation and greater market power. So we have dysfunctional pockets of finance and huge banks and half measures to solve these things.
Well, let's look at it from the bank's point of view. If I knew that the current practices could allow for my bank to lose $6 billion and probably not the only place where I'd be losing money, but in just with one banker, wouldn't I want to, at least if not go to Congress to have things change within my own institution some of these things and stop engaging in these risky practices instead of fighting to be able to continue engaging in them?
So there are a bunch of problems here. One is that individual bankers continue to be incentivized often to take risks within their own institutions that would hurt their own institutions. That was something that led up to the financial crisis.
Incentivized because they make big bonuses.
They make big bonuses, and that's sort of the, you know, their units look profitable to the higher ups, and the top guys, the Jamie Dimons of the world, simply cannot manage these institutions, but they're giant empires, and giant empires pay them more than small empires, and so they have great incentives to keep this kind of cushy job, even though they can't manage these institutions. And then there's the classic the saying, but it's I'll be gone, you'll be gone. Mm.
When it hits the fan, we'll both be gone
we'll be
anyway.
Gone. Exactly.
So somebody else is going to have to take the blame at that point.
Somebody else takes the blame, or you can fire a subordinate or something.
Now, opponents of broader regulation often argued that it will encourage investors to move their capital elsewhere. Is that a reasonable fear?
Not at all. I think that the what we would want is for risky banks to go abroad, because the costs of blowing up our economy are much greater than the benefits that we've gotten from them. There are numerous studies now that explain that sophisticated, complex, giant financial institutions aren't actually helping the economy as a whole. They're probably a rentier class. They're probably taking rents from the economy, costing the economy money.
Is this just an American problem? Because there are some other scandals, like the manipulation of LIBOR, which involved London. Obviously, it's the London Interbank Offered Rate. HSBC, a British-based bank, has been caught helping drug dealers launder money. Standard Chartered has been funneling cash to Iran.
Yep.
So
yep.
Does this kind of behavior is this just the way things are done in the banking industry?
The bad
throughout
behavior
the world?
Is certainly European and American. To the extent that we know about Chinese and Japanese banks, which we don't know, we know even less about them. I'm sure that they're engaged in bad behavior too. So this is a global problem, and the regulators all over the world are struggling with this problem. The UK, I believe, has been a little bit stronger in response. Switzerland is requiring much higher capital from its banks because they had the fear of God put into them when their two big banks, UBS and Credit Suisse, almost went to the wall. So I think that there's been a stronger response abroad than there has been in the U.S.
But Switzerland has been the leader in the fight against transparency until fairly recently. You could be pretty sure that if you had money in a Swiss bank account, that nobody would know about it.
Yes. No, that was a completely – that's a sort of separate issue, which is that they've been protecting their tax cheats for decades now. But in the in after the financial crisis, they realized that their institutions were literally bigger than the country, and they could, that was not sustainable, and they had to be much safer, and they're working towards that now.
So what do you see for the future? Is it just going to be continuing this way where every so often there'll be another story of some scandal at some bank, but we'll muddle on?
Well, you could be extremely pessimistic and say that there's nothing that can be done before then. We'll need another crisis before anything can be done.
And maybe another Congress.
It would take more than another Congress, because I don't think that the Democrats are particularly pro-financial reform either.
Well, New York, for example, is represented by mostly Democrats, and they see the banks as something to be protected.
Yeah,
after
exactly.
All, they
it's
are all a, located here.
Chuck Schumer is the senator from Wall Street, and Gillibrand is also very friendly towards Wall Street. So the Democrats have, Wall Street turned away from Obama in the last election, but there's no sign that they're remotely interested in making them pay for that, the Democrats, that is. Now, what the issue is that Congress is just not particularly interested in having a big reform. There is possibly a grand bargain here, which says we will sweep away a lot of this extraneous reform, all this redundant reform, or sorry, regulation. We have multiple regulators overseeing the banks, and we could sweep this away for in return for higher capital requirements and much simpler disclosure and a real risk that you go to prison. Now, I think that bankers might take that offer, but it's not on the table right now.
They might also issue annual reports that you could actually understand?
Well, that's the hope, is that if you had a real risk that you were going to go to prison, your annual report would be strunk and white. It would be as clear as the elements of style. We think that that's possible. We think that it is possible to disclose real risks of your business, and that the incentives are to not do it, in fact, to obfuscate them.
The article we've been discussing, What's Inside America's Banks, is in the current issue of The Atlantic, written by Frank Partnoy, a professor of law and finance at the University of San Diego School of Law, and our guest, Jesse Eisinger, a senior reporter at ProPublica and a columnist for the New York Times Deal Book section. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks. I always enjoy it.